said Connor. Either you did or this other girl I dated for a while around the same time called Teresa. I always get the two of you mixed up. Tess pushed her elbow into his side. You are a good memory, said Connor in a more serious voice. I was happy to see you again the other day. Me too, said Tess. I was happy to see you. Liar. You looked horrified. I was surprised. She changed the subject. Do you still have a waterbed? Sadly, the waterbed didn't make it into the new millennium, said Connor. I think it made Teresa seasick. Stop talking about Teresa, said Tess. All right. Do you want to move somewhere more comfortable? I'm okay. They lay in companionable silence for a few moments, and then Tess said, what are you doing? Just seeing if I still know my way around the place. That's a bit, I don't know, rude? Sexist? Oh. Oh, well. Do you like that, Teresa? Oh, wait. What was your name again? Stop talking, please. Chapter 30. Cecilia sat on the couch next to Esther, watching YouTube videos of the cold, clear November night in 1989 when the Berlin Wall came down. She was becoming obsessed with the wall herself. After John Paul's mother had left, she'd stayed sitting at the kitchen table, reading one of Esther's books, until it was time to pick the girls up from school. There were so many things she should have been doing. Tupperware deliveries, preparations for Easter Sunday, the pirate party. But reading about the wall was a good way of pretending she wasn't thinking about what she was really thinking about. Esther was drinking warm milk. Cecilia was drinking her third, or fourth, glass of Sauvignon Blanc. John Paul was listening to Polly do her reading. Isabel sat at the computer in the family room, downloading music onto her iPod. Their home was a cozy, lamp-lit bubble of domesticity. Cecilia sniffed. The scent of sesame oil seemed to have pervaded the whole house now. "Look, Mum." Esther elbowed her. "I'm watching," said Cecilia. Cecilia's memories of the news footage she'd seen back in 1989 were rowdier than this. She remembered crowds of people dancing on top of the wall, fists punching the air. Wasn't David Hasselhoff singing at some point? But there was a strange, eerie quietness to the clips Esther had found. The people walking out from East Berlin seemed quietly stunned, exhilarated but calm, filing out in such an orderly fashion. They were Germans, after all. Cecilia's sort of people. Men and women with 80s hairstyles drank champagne straight from the bottle, tipping their heads back and smiling at the cameras. They hooted and hugged and wept. They tooted the horns of their cars. But they all seemed so well-behaved, so very nice about it. Even the people slamming sledgehammers against the wall seemed to do so with controlled jubilation, not vicious fury. Cecilia watched a woman of about her own age dance in circles with a bearded man in a leather jacket. "Why are you crying, Mum?" asked Esther. "Because they're so happy," said Cecilia. "Because they endured this unacceptable thing. Because that woman probably thought, like so many people had, that the wall would eventually come down, but not in her lifetime. That she would never see this day. And yet she had. And now she was dancing. It's weird how you always cry about happy things," said Esther. "I know," said Cecilia. Happy endings always made her cry. It was the relief. "Would you like a cup of tea?" John Paul stood up from the dining room table while Polly put away her book. He looked at Cecilia anxiously. All evening she'd been aware of his timid, solicitous glances. It was driving her crazy. "No," said Cecilia sharply, avoiding his eyes. She felt the perplexed gaze of her daughters. "I do not want a cup of tea." Chapter 31. "I remember Felicity," said Connor. "She was funny, quick-witted, a bit scary." They'd moved to Connor's bed. It was an ordinary queen-sized mattress with plain white Egyptian cotton sheets. She'd forgotten that, how he loved good sheets, like in a hotel. Connor had heated up some leftover pasta he'd made the night before, and they were eating it in bed. "We should be civilized and sit at the table," Connor had offered. "I could make a salad. Put out placemats." "Let's just stay here," Tess had said. "I might remember to feel awkward about this." "Good point," Connor had said. The pasta was delicious. Tess ate hungrily. She felt that ravenous sensation she used to feel when Liam was a baby and she'd been up all night breastfeeding. Except instead of a night innocently suckling her son, she'd just had two very boisterous, highly satisfying sexual encounters with a man who was not her husband. She should have lost her appetite, not got it back. "So she and your husband are having an affair," said Connor. "No," said Tess, "they just fell in love. It's all very pure and romantic." "That's horrible." "I know," said Tess. "I only found out on Monday. And here I am." She waved her fork around the room and at herself and her own state of undress. She was wearing nothing but a T-shirt of Connor's, which he'd taken from a drawer and handed her, without comment, before he went off to make the pasta. It smelled very clean. "Eating pasta," finished Connor. "Eating excellent pasta," agreed Tess. "Wasn't Felicity quite a..." Connor searched for the right word. "How can I put this without sounding..." "Wasn't she quite a sturdy girl?" "She was morbidly obese," said Tess. "It is relevant because this year she lost 40 kilos and became extremely beautiful." "Oh," said Connor. He paused. "So what do you think is going to happen?" "I have no idea," said Tess. "Last week I thought my marriage was good. As good as a marriage can be. And then they made this announcement. I was in shock. I'm still in shock. But then again, look at me. Within 3 days, actually 2 days, I'm with an ex-boyfriend eating pasta." "Things just happen sometimes," said Connor. "Don't worry about it." Tess finished the pasta and ran her finger around the bowl. "Why are you single? You can cook. You can do other things." She gestured vaguely at the bed. "Very well." "I've been pining for you all these years." He was straight-faced. "No, you haven't," said Tess. She frowned. "That is, you haven't, have you?" Connor took her empty bowl and placed it inside his own bowl. He put them both on the bedside table. Then he lay back against his pillow. "I did actually pine for you for a while," he admitted. Tessa's cheerful feeling began to slip. "I'm sorry. I had no idea." "Tess," interrupted Connor, "relax. It was a long time ago, and we didn't even go out for that long. It was the age of difference. I was a boring accountant, and you were young and ready for adventures. But I did sometimes wonder what could have been. Tess had never wondered. Not even once. She'd barely thought of Connor. "So you never married?" she asked. "I lived with a woman for a number of years. A lawyer. We were both on track for partnership and marriage, I guess. But then my sister died, and everything changed. I was looking after Ben. I lost interest in accounting around the same time that Antonia lost interest in me. And then I decided to do my degree in physical education. But I still don't get it. There's a single dad at Liam's school in Melbourne, and the women swarm all over him. It's embarrassing to watch." "Well," said Connor, "I never said they didn't swarm." "So you've just been playing the field all these years," said Tess. "Sort of," said Connor. He went to speak and then stopped. "What?" "No, nothing. Go on." "I was just going to admit something."
"Something juicy?"
guessed Tess. "Don't worry, I've become very open-minded ever since my husband suggested I live in the same house as him and his lover." Connor gave her a sympathetic smile. "Not that juicy. I was going to say that I've been seeing a therapist for the last year. I've been, how do people put it, working through some stuff."
"Oh," said Tess carefully.
"You've got that careful look on your face," said Connor. "I'm not crazy. I just had a few issues I needed to cover off."
"Serious issues?" asked Tess, not sure if she really wanted to know. This was meant to be an interlude from all the serious stuff, a crazy little escapade. She was letting off steam. She was aware of herself already trying to define it, to package it in a way that made it acceptable. Perhaps the self-loathing was about to hit.
"When we were going out," said Connor, "did I ever tell you that I was the last person to see Janie Crowley alive? Rachel Crowley's daughter."
"I know who she is," said Tess. "I'm pretty sure you never told me that."
"Actually, I know I wouldn't have told you," said Connor, "because I never talked about it. Hardly anyone knew, except for the police. And Janie's mother. I sometimes think that Rachel Crowley thinks I did it. She looks at me in this intense way."
Tess felt a chill. He murdered Janie Crowley, and now he was about to murder Tess, and then everyone would know that she'd used her husband's romantic predicament as an excuse to jump into bed with an ex-boyfriend.
"And did you?" she asked. Connor's head jerked back as if she'd slapped him. "Tess! No! Of course not!"
"Sorry."
Tess relaxed back against her pillow. "Of course he didn't. Jeez, I can't believe you would think... Sorry, sorry. So, was Janie a friend? Girlfriend?" "I wanted her to be my girlfriend," said Connor. "I was pretty hung up on her. She'd come over to my place after school, and we'd make out on my bed, and then I'd get all serious and angry and say, 'Okay, this means you're my girlfriend, right?' I was desperate for commitment. I wanted everything signed and sealed. My first girlfriend. Only she'd hum and ha and was all, 'Well, I don't know, I'm still deciding.' I was losing my mind over it all. But then on the morning of the day she died, she told me
that she'd decided. I'd got the job, so to speak. I was stoked. Thought I'd won the lottery.
Connor, said Tess, I'm so sorry.
She came over that afternoon and we ate fish and chips in my room and kissed for about 30 hours or so. And then I saw her off at the railway station. And next morning I heard on the radio that a girl had been found strangled at Wattle Valley Park.
My God, said Tess, uselessly. She felt out of her depth, similar to the way she'd felt when she and her mother were sitting across the desk from Rachel Crowley the other day, filling in Liam's enrollment forms. And she kept thinking to herself, her daughter was murdered. She couldn't link Connor's experience to anything even remotely similar in her own life, and so she didn't seem able to converse with him in any normal way. Finally, she said, I can't believe you never told me any of this when we were together. Although, really, why should he have? They'd only gone out together for 6 months. Even married couples didn't share everything. She had never told Will about her self-diagnosis of social anxiety. The very thought of telling him made her toes curl with embarrassment.
I lived with Antonia for years before I finally told her, said Connor.
She was offended.
We seemed to talk more about how offended she was than what actually happened. I think that's probably why we broke up in the end. My failure to share.
I guess girls like to know stuff, said Tess.
There was one part of the story I never told Antonia, said Connor. I never told anyone until I told this therapist woman. My shrink.
He stopped.
You don't have to tell me, said Tess nobly.
Okay, let's talk about something else, said Connor.
Tess swatted at him. My mother lied for me, said Connor.
What do you mean?
You never had the pleasure of meeting my mother, did you? She died before we met.
Another memory of her time with Connor floated to the surface. She'd asked him about his parents, and he said,
My father left when I was a baby. My mother died when I was 21. My mother was a drunk. That's all I have to say about her.
Mother issues, said Felicity when Tess repeated this conversation, run a mile.
My mother and her boyfriend told the police that I was home with them from 5 o'clock that night. I wasn't. I was home alone. They were out getting drunk somewhere. I never asked them to lie for me. My mother just did it, automatically. And she loved it, lying to the police. When the police left, she winked at me as she held the front door for them. Winked! As if she and I were in cahoots. It made me feel as if I had done it. But what could I do? I couldn't tell them that Mum had just lied for me, because that would make it look as if she thought I had something to hide.
But you're not saying she actually thought you did it, said Tess.
After the police left, she held up a finger like this and said, Connor, baby, I don't want to know. As if she was in a movie. And I said, Mum, I didn't do it. And she just said, Pour me a wine, doll. After that, whenever she got nasty drunk, she'd say, You owe me, you ungrateful little bastard. Gave me a permanent sense of guilt. Almost as if I had done it. He shuddered. Anyway, I grew up. Mum died. I never talked about Janie. I never even let myself think about her. And then my sister died. And I got Ben, and straight after my teaching degree, I got offered the job at St. Angela's. I didn't even know that Janie's mother was working there until my second day of work. That must be strange. We don't run into each other that often. I did try to talk to her about Janie in the very beginning, but she made it clear she wasn't interested in being chatty. So, I started telling you all this because you asked why I was single. My very expensive therapist thinks I've been subconsciously sabotaging relationships because I don't think I deserve to be happy, because of my guilt over what I didn't actually do to Janie. He smiled shamefacedly at Tess. So there you go. I'm extremely damaged. Not your run-of-the-mill accountant turned PE teacher. Tess took his hand in hers and laced her fingers through his. She looked at their interlocked hands, struck by the fact that she was holding another man's hand, even though just moments before she'd been doing things that most people would have considered far more intimate. "I'm sorry," she said.
"Why are you sorry?"
"I'm sorry about Janie and your sister dying." She paused. "And I'm really sorry I broke up with you like I did." Connor made the sign of the cross over her head. "I absolve you of your sins, my child." Or whatever it is they say. "It's been a while since my last confession."
"Mine too," said Tess. "I think you were meant to give me penance before you absolved me."
"Oh, I can think of penance, baby." Tess giggled. She unlaced her fingers. "I should go." "I've scared you off with all my issues," said Connor.
"No, you haven't. I just don't want my mother getting worried. She'll wait up for me, and she won't expect me to be this late."
She remembered suddenly why they were meant to be getting together. "Hey, we never talked about your nephew. You wanted to ask me some career advice or something?" Connor smiled.
"Ben's already got a job.
I just wanted an excuse to see you."
"Really?"
Tess felt a flare of happiness. Was there anything better than to be wanted? Was that all anyone really needed?
"Yep."
They looked at each other. "Connor," she began.
"Don't worry," he said. "I don't have any expectations. I know exactly what this is."
"What is it?" asked Tess with interest. He paused.
"I'm not sure. I'll check with my therapist and let you know."
Tess snorted. "I really should go," she said again. But it was another half hour before she finally put her clothes back on. Chapter 32. Cecilia went into the ensuite bathroom where John Paul was brushing his teeth. She picked up her toothbrush, squeezed toothpaste on it, and began to brush, her eyes not meeting his in the mirror. She stopped brushing.
"Your mother knows," she said.
John Paul bent down to the basin and spat.
"What do you mean?"
He straightened, patted his mouth with the hand towel, and shoved it back on the handrail in such a slapdash way that you'd think he was deliberately trying to avoid keeping it straight.
"She knows," said Cecilia again. He spun around. "You told her?"
"No, I..."
"Why would you do that?"
The colour had drained from his face. He didn't seem angry so much as utterly stunned.
"John Paul, I didn't tell her. I mentioned Rachel was coming to Polly's party, and she asked how you felt about that. I could just tell."
John Paul's shoulders relaxed.
"You must have imagined it."
He sounded so certain. Whenever they had an argument about a point of fact, he was always so utterly confident that he had it right and she had it wrong. He never even entertained the possibility that he might be mistaken. It drove her bananas. She struggled with an almost irresistible urge to slap him across the face. This was the problem. All his flaws seemed more significant now. It was one thing for a gentle, law-abiding husband and father to have failings, a certain inflexibility that manifested itself just when it was most inconvenient. Those occasional, also inconvenient, black moods, the frustrating implacability during arguments, the untidiness, the constant losing of his possessions. They all seemed innocuous enough, common even. But now that these faults belonged to a murderer, they seemed to matter so much more, to define him. His good qualities now seemed irrelevant and probably fraudulent, a cover identity. How could she ever look at him again in the same way? How could she still love him? She didn't know him. She'd been in love with an optical illusion. The blue eyes that had looked at her with tenderness and passion and laughter were the same eyes that Janie had seen in those terrifying few moments before she died. Those lovely strong hands that had cupped the soft, fragile heads of Cecilia's baby daughters were the same hands that he held around Janie's neck. "Your mother knows," she told him. She recognized her rosary beads in the newspaper pictures. "She basically told me that a mother would do anything for her children, and that I should do the same for my children and pretend it never happened. It was creepy. Your mother is creepy." It felt like crossing a line to say that. John Paul did not take criticism of his mother kindly. Cecilia normally tried to respect that, even while it annoyed her. John Paul sank down on the side of the bath, knocking the hand towel off the rail with his knees in the process. "You really think she knows?"
"Yes," said Cecilia. "So there you go. Mummy's golden boy really can get away with murder."
John Paul blinked, and Cecilia almost considered apologizing before she remembered that this wasn't an ordinary disagreement about packing the dishwasher. The rules had changed. She could be just as narky as she pleased. She picked up her toothbrush again and began to clean her teeth with harsh mechanical movements. Her dentist had told her just last week that she was brushing too hard, wearing away the enamel. "Hold your toothbrush with your fingertips, like the bow of a violin," he'd said, demonstrating. Should she get another electric toothbrush, she'd wondered, and he'd said he wasn't a believer, except for the old and arthritic. But Cecilia had said she liked the nice clean feeling it gave her, and oh, it had all genuinely mattered. She'd been completely involved in that conversation. A conversation about the maintenance of her teeth. Back then, back in last week. She rinsed and spat and put the toothbrush away and picked up the towel that John Paul had knocked onto the floor and put it back on the railing. She glanced at John Paul. He flinched. "The way you look at me now," he said, "it's..." He stopped and took a shaky breath.
"What do you expect?"
asked Cecilia, astounded. "I'm so sorry," said John Paul. "I'm so sorry for putting you through this, for making you part of it. I'm such an idiot for writing that letter. But I'm still me, Cecilia. I promise you. Please don't think I'm some evil monster. I was 17, Cecilia. I made one terrible, terrible mistake."
"Which you never paid for," said Cecilia.
"I know I didn't." He met her eyes unflinchingly. "I know that."
They stood in silence for a few moments.
Shit!
Cecilia slammed her hand to her head.
Fuck it!
What is it?
John Paul reeled back. She never swore. All these years, there had been a Tupperware container of bad language sitting off to the side in her head. And now she'd opened it, and all those crisp, crunchy words were lovely and fresh, ready to be used.
Easter hats, she said. Polly and Esther need fucking Easter hats for tomorrow morning.
The 6th of April, 1984. Jamie very nearly changed her mind when she looked out the window of the train and saw John Paul waiting for her on the platform. He was reading a book, his long legs stuck out in front of him. And when he saw the train pulling in, he stood up and stuck the book in his back pocket. And with a sudden, almost furtive movement, he smoothed down his hair with the palm of his hand. He was gorgeous. She got up from her seat, holding the pole for balance, and slung her bag over her shoulder. It was funny the way he'd smoothed down his hair. It was an insecure gesture for a boy like John Paul. You'd almost think that he was nervous about seeing Janie, that he was worried about impressing her.
Next stop, Asquith, then all stations to Barowra.
The train clattered to a stop. So this was it. She was going to tell him that she couldn't see him anymore. She could have stood him up, just left him waiting for her. But she wasn't that type of girl. She could have telephoned him. But that didn't seem right either. Besides, they'd never called each other. Both of them had mothers who liked to lurk about when they were on the phone. If only she could have emailed or texted him, that would have solved everything. But mobile phones and the internet were still in the future. She'd been thinking that this would be unpleasant and that maybe John Paul's pride would be hurt and that he might say something vengeful like, I never liked you that much anyway. But until she saw him smoothing down his hair, it hadn't occurred to her that she might be about to hurt him. She felt sick at the thought. She got off the train and John Paul lifted a hand and smiled. Janie waved back, and as she walked down the railway platform towards him, it came to her with a tiny bitter shock of self-revelation that it wasn't that she liked Connor more than John Paul. It was that she liked John Paul far too much. It was a strain being with someone so good-looking and smart and funny and nice. She was dazzled by John Paul. Connor was dazzled by her. And it was more fun doing the dazzling. Girls were meant to do the dazzling. John Paul's interest felt like a trick, a practical joke, because surely he knew that she wasn't good enough for him. She kept waiting for a gaggle of teenage girls to appear, laughing and jeering and pointing. You didn't really think he'd be interested in you? That's why she hadn't even told any of her friends about his existence. They knew about Connor, of course, but not John Paul Fitzpatrick. They wouldn't believe that someone like John Paul would be interested in her, and she didn't really believe it either. She thought of Connor's big, goofy smile on the bus when she told him he was now officially her boyfriend. He was her friend. Losing her virginity to Connor would be sweet and funny and tender. She couldn't possibly take her clothes off in front of John Paul. The very thought made her heart stop. Besides, he deserved a girl with a body that matched his. He might laugh if he saw her strange, skinny, white body. He might notice that her arms were disproportionately long for her body. He might sneer or snort at her concave chest. Hi, she said to him. Hi, he said. And she caught her breath, because as their eyes met, she got that feeling again, that sensation of there being something huge between them, something she couldn't quite define, something her 20-year-old self might have called passion, and her 30-year-old self might have more cynically called chemistry. A tiny speck of her, a tiny speck of the woman she could have become, thought, "Come on, Janie, you're being a coward. You like him more than Connor. Choose him. This could be big. This could be huge. This could be love." But her heart was hammering so hard, it was horrible, scary, and painful. She could barely breathe. There was a painful, crushing sensation in the center of her chest, as if someone was trying to flatten her. She just wanted to feel normal again. "I need to talk to you about something," she said. And she made her voice cold and hard, sealing her fate like an envelope. Thursday. Chapter 33. "Cecilia, did you get my messages? I've been trying to call."
"Cecilia, you are right about those raffle tickets."
"Cecilia, you weren't at Pilates yesterday."
"Cecilia, my sister-in-law wants to book a party with you." "Cecilia, is there any chance you could take Harriet just for an hour after ballet next week?"
"Cecilia!"
"Cecilia!
Cecilia!"
It was the Easter hat parade, and the St. Angela's mothers were out in force, dressed up in honour of Easter and the first truly autumnal day of the new season. Soft, pretty scarves looped necks. Skinny jeans encased skinny and not-so-skinny thighs. Spike-heeled boots tapped across the playground. It had been a humid summer, and the crispness of the breeze and the anticipation of a 4-day chocolate-filled weekend had put everyone in good moods. The mothers, sitting in a big double-rowed circle of blue fold-up chairs around the quadrangle, were frisky and high-spirited. The older children, who weren't taking part in the Easter hat parade, had been brought outside to watch, and they hung over the balconies with dangling, nonchalant arms and mature, tolerant expressions to indicate that, of course, they were now far too old for this sort of thing. But weren't the little ones cute? Cecilia looked for Isabel on the Year 6 balcony and saw her standing in between her best friends, Marie and Laura. The three girls had their arms slung around each other, indicating that their tumultuous three-way relationship was currently at a high point, where nobody was being ganged up on by the other two, and their love for each other was pure and intense. It was lucky that there was no school for the next 4 days, because their intense times were inevitably followed by tears and betrayal, and long, exhausting stories of "she said, she texted, she posted," and "I said, I texted, I posted." One of the mothers discreetly passed around a basket of Belgian chocolate balls, and there were moans of drunken, sensual pleasure. "I'm a murderer's wife," thought Cecilia, while Belgian chocolate melted in her mouth. "I'm an accessory to murder," she thought, as she set up play dates and pickups and Tupperware parties, as she scheduled and organized and set things in action. "I'm Cecilia Fitzpatrick, and my husband is a murderer, and look at me, talking and chatting and laughing and hugging my kids. You'd never know." This was how it could be done. This was how you lived with a secret. You just did it. You pretended everything was fine. You ignored the deep, cramp-like pain in your stomach. You somehow anesthetized yourself so that nothing felt that bad, but nothing felt that good either. Yesterday she'd thrown up in the gutter and cried in the pantry,
But this morning she'd got up at 6 a.m. and made 2 lasagnas to go into the freezer ready for Easter Sunday, and ironed a basket of clothes and sent 3 emails inquiring about tennis lessons for Polly, and answered 14 emails about various school matters, and put in her Tupperware order from the party the other night, and got a load of laundry on the line. All before the girls and John Paul were out of bed. She was back on her skates, twirling expertly about the slippery surface of her life.
"Give me strength. What is that woman wearing?" said someone, as the school principal appeared in the center of the yard.
Trudy was wearing long rabbit ears and a fluffy tail pinned to her bottom. She looked like a motherly playboy bunny. Trudy hopped to the microphone in the middle of the yard, with her hands curled up in front of her like paws. The mothers rocked with fond laughter. The kids on the balconies cheered.
"Ladies and jelly beans, girls and boys."
One of Trudy's rabbit ears slipped down over her face, and she brushed it away.
"Welcome to the St. Angela's Easter Hat Parade."
"I love her to death," said Mahalia, who was sitting on Cecilia's right. "But it really is hard to believe she runs a school."
"Trudy doesn't run the school," said Laura Marks, who was sitting on her other side. "Rachel Crowley runs the school, together with the lovely lady on your left."
Laura leaned in front of Mahalia and waggled her fingers at Cecilia.
Now, you know that's not true."
Cecilia smiled roguishly. She felt like a demented parody of herself. Surely she was overdoing it. Everything she did felt exaggerated and clown-like, but nobody seemed to notice.
The music began, pounding out through the state-of-the-art sound system that Cecilia's highly successful art show raffle had paid for last year. The conversation rippled around her.
"Who chose the playlist? It's quite good."
"I know, it makes me feel like dancing."
"Yes, but is anybody listening to the lyrics? Do you know what this song is about?"
"Best not to. My kids know them all anyway."
The KP class was the first to file out, led by their teacher, the rather beautiful busty brunette, Miss Parker, who had made the best use of her natural assets by dressing up in a fairy princess dress that was 2 sizes too small for her, and was dancing along to the music in a manner perhaps not quite befitting a kindergarten teacher. The tiny kindergartners followed her, grinning proudly and self-consciously, carefully balancing the familiar Easter hat creations on their heads. The mothers congratulated one another on their children's hats.
"Oh, Sandra, creative."
"Found it on the internet. Took me 10 minutes.
"Sure it did. Seriously, I swear.
Does Miss Parker realize this is an Easter hat parade, not a nightclub?"
"Do fairy princesses normally show that much cleavage? And, by the way, does a tiara really count as an Easter hat?"
"I think she's trying to get Mr. Whitby's attention, poor girl. He's not even looking."
Cecilia adored events just like these. An Easter hat parade summed up everything she loved about her life. The sweetness and simplicity of it all. The sense of community. But today the parade seemed pointless. The children snotty-nosed. The mothers bitchy. She stifled a yawn and smelled sesame oil on her fingers. It was the scent of her life now. Another yawn overtook her. She and John Paul had been up late making the girls' Easter hats in strained silence. Polly's class made their appearance, led by the adorable Mrs. Jeffers, who had gone to a tremendous lot of trouble to dress as a gigantic, shiny pink, foil-wrapped Easter egg. Polly was right behind her teacher, strutting along like a supermodel, wearing her Easter hat tilted rakishly over one eye. John Paul had made her a bird's nest out of sticks from the garden and filled it with Easter eggs.
A fluffy yellow toy chick emerged from one of the eggs, as if it were hatching.
"My Lord, Cecilia, you're an absolute freak!"
Erica Edgecliffe, who was sitting in the row in front of Cecilia, turned round.
"Polly's hat looks amazing!"
"John Paul made it." Cecilia waved at Polly.
"Seriously, that man is a catch," said Erica.
"He's a catch, all right,"
agreed Cecilia, hearing a weird lilt in her voice. She sensed Mahalia turning to look at her.
Erica said, "You know me. Forgot all about the Easter hat parade until this morning at breakfast. Then I stuck an old egg carton on Emily's head and said, 'That'll have to do, kid.'"
Erica took pride in her haphazard approach to mothering.
"There she is! Em! Woo!"
Erica half stood, waving frantically, and then subsided.
"Did you see that death stare she sent me? She knows it's the worst hat in the parade. Someone give me another one of those chocolate balls before I shoot myself."
"Are you feeling okay, Cecilia?" Mahalia leaned closer, so that Cecilia could smell the familiar musky scent of her perfume. Cecilia glanced over at Mahalia and looked quickly away. "Oh no, don't you dare be nice to me, Mahalia, with your smooth skin and the whites of your eyes so pearly white." Cecilia had noticed tiny splotches of red in the whites of her eyes this morning. "Wasn't that what happened when someone tried to strangle you? The capillaries in your eyes burst." How did she know that? She shuddered.
"You're shivering," said Mahalia. "That breeze is icy."
"I'm fine," said Cecilia. The longing to confide in someone, anyone, felt like a raging thirst. She cleared her throat.
"Might be coming down with a cold."
"Here, put this around you." Mahalia pulled the scarf from around her neck and settled it over Cecilia's shoulders. It was a beautiful scarf, and Mahalia's beautiful scent drifted all around her.
"No, no,"
said Cecilia, ineffectually. She knew exactly what Mahalia would say if she told her. "It's very simple, Cecilia. Tell your husband he has 24 hours to confess, or you're going to the police yourself. Yes, you love your husband, and yes, your children will suffer as a result, but none of that is the point. It's very simple." Mahalia was very fond of the word, simple.
"Horseradish and garlic," said Mahalia. "Simple."
"What?
Oh, yes, for my cold, absolutely. I've got some at home."
Cecilia caught sight of Tess O'Leary sitting on the other side of the quadrangle with her mother's wheelchair parked at the end of the row of chairs. Cecilia reminded herself that she must thank Tess for everything she'd done yesterday and apologize for not even offering to call a taxi. The poor girl must have walked all the way back up the hill to her mother's house. Also, she'd promised to make a lasagna for Lucy. Maybe she wasn't skating as expertly as she'd thought. She was making lots of tiny mistakes that would eventually cause everything to fall apart. Was it only Tuesday that Cecilia had been driving Polly to ballet and longing for some huge wave of emotion to sweep her off her feet? The Cecilia of 2 days ago had been a fool. She'd wanted the wave of clean, beautiful emotion you felt when you saw a heart-swelling movie scene with a magnificent soundtrack. She hadn't wanted anything that would actually hurt.
"Oops, oops, it's gonna go,"
said Erica. A boy from the other year one class was wearing an actual birdcage on his head. The little boy, Luke Lahaney, Mary Lahaney's son. Mary often overstepped the mark. She'd once made the mistake of running against Cecilia for the role of PNC president.
was walking along like the Leaning Tower of Pisa with his whole body tipped to one side in a desperate attempt to keep the birdcage upright. Suddenly, inevitably, it slipped from his head, crashing to the ground and causing Bonnie Emerson to trip and lose her own hat. Bonnie's face crumpled, while Luke stared in bewildered horror at his mangled birdcage.
"I want my mother too," thought Cecilia, as she watched Luke and Bonnie's mothers rush to retrieve their children. "I want my mother to comfort me, to tell me that everything is going to be okay, and that there's no need to cry."
Normally, her mother would be at the Easter Hat Parade, snapping blurry, headless photos of the girls with her disposable camera. But this year she'd gone to Sam's parade at the exclusive preschool. There was going to be champagne for the grown-ups.
"Isn't that the silliest thing you've ever heard?" she said to Cecilia. "Champagne at an Easter Hat Parade. That's where Bridget's fees are going."
Cecilia's mother loved champagne. She'd be having the time of her life hobnobbing with a better class of grandmas than you got at St. Angela's. She'd always made a point of pretending not to be interested in money, because she was, in fact, very interested in it. What would her mother say if she told her about John Paul? Cecilia had noticed that as her mother got older, whenever she heard anything distressing or just too complicated, there was a disturbing moment where her face became dull and slack, like a stroke victim, as if her mind had momentarily closed down from the shock.
"John Paul committed a crime," Cecilia would begin. "Oh, darling, I'm sure he didn't," her mother would interrupt. What would Cecilia's dad say? He had high blood pressure. It might actually kill him. She imagined the flash of terror that would cross his soft, wrinkled face before he recovered himself, frowning ferociously while he tried to slot the information into the right box in his mind.
"What does John Paul think?" he'd probably say, automatically, because the older her parents got, the more they seemed to rely on John Paul's opinion. Her parents couldn't cope without John Paul in their lives, and they would never cope with the knowledge of what he'd done, or the shame in their community. He had to weigh up the greater good. Life wasn't black and white. Confessing wouldn't bring back Janie. It would achieve nothing. It would hurt Cecilia's daughters. It would hurt Cecilia's parents. It would hurt John Paul. For a mistake. She hurried over that soft little word, mistake, knowing that it wasn't right, that there had to be a bigger word for what John Paul had done. He'd made when he was 17 years old.
"There's Esther."
Cecilia was startled by Mahalia nudging her. She'd forgotten where she was. Cecilia looked up in time to see Esther nod coolly at her as she walked by, her hat stuck right on the back of her head, the sleeves of her jumper pulled right down to cover her hands like mittens. She was wearing an old straw hat of Cecilia's with fake flowers and tiny chocolate eggs stuck all over it. Not Cecilia's best effort, but it didn't matter, because Esther thought Easter hat parades were a waste of her valuable time. "What does the Easter hat parade actually teach us?" she'd said to Cecilia that morning in the car.
"Nothing about the Berlin Wall," Isabel had said smartly.
Cecilia had pretended not to notice that Isabel was wearing her mascara this morning. She'd done a good job of it. Only one tiny blue-black smudge just below her perfect eyebrow. She looked up to the Year 6 balcony and saw Isabel and her friends dancing to the music. If a nice young boy murdered Isabel and got away with it, and if that boy felt very remorseful and turned out to be a fine, upstanding member of the community, a good father and a good son-in-law, Cecilia would still want him jailed.
executed. She'd want to kill him with her own bare hands. The world tipped. She heard Mahalia say from a very long way away, "Cecilia?"
Chapter 34. Tess shifted in her seat and felt a pleasurable ache in her groin. "Just how superficial are you? What happened to your supposedly broken heart? So, what, it takes you 3 days to get over a marriage breakup?" Here she was, sitting at the St. Angela's Easter Hat Parade, thinking about sex with one of the three parade judges, who was right now on the other side of the schoolyard, wearing a giant pink baby's bonnet tied under his chin, and doing the chicken dance with a group of Year 6 boys. "Isn't this lovely?" said her mother beside her. "This is just lovely. I wish..." She stopped, and Tess turned to study her.
"You wish what?"
Lucy looked guilty.
"I was just wishing that the circumstances were happier, that you and Will had decided to move to Sydney, and that Liam was at St. Angela's, and I could always come to his Easter hat parades. Sorry."
"You don't need to be sorry," said Tess. "I wish that too."
Did she wish that?
She turned her gaze back to Connor. The Year 6 boys were now laughing with such crazy abandon at something Connor had just said that Tess suspected fart jokes must be involved.
"How was last night?" said Lucy. "I forgot to ask. Actually, I didn't even hear you come in."
"It was nice," said Tess. "Nice to catch up." She had a sudden image of Connor flipping her over and saying in her ear, "I seem to remember this used to work quite well for us." Even before, when he was a young, boring accountant with a nerdy hairstyle, before he got the killer body and the motorbike, he'd been good in bed. Tess had been too young to appreciate it. She'd thought all sex was as good as that. She shifted again in her seat. She was probably about to get a bout of cystitis. That would teach her. The last time she'd had sex 3 times in a row, and not so coincidentally the last time she'd got cystitis, was when she and Will had first started dating. Thinking about Will and their early days together should hurt, but it didn't. Not right now, at least. She felt light-headed with wicked, delicious sexual satisfaction. And what else? Vengeance. That was it. "Vengeance is mine," saith Tess. Will and Felicity thought she was up here in Sydney nursing a broken heart, when in fact she was having excellent sex with her ex-boyfriend. Sex with an ex. It left married sex for dead. So there, Will. "Tess, my darling," said her mother.
"Hmm?"
Her mother lowered her voice.
"Did something happen last night between you and Connor?"
"Of course not," said Tess. "I couldn't possibly," she'd said to Connor that third time, and he'd said, "I bet you could," and she'd murmured, "I couldn't, I couldn't, I couldn't," over and over, until it was established that she could.
"Tess O'Leary," said her mother, just as a Year 1 boy's birdcage hat slipped from his head. Tess met her mother's eyes and laughed.
"Oh, darling," Lucy grabbed hold of her arm, "good on you. The man is an absolute spunk."
Chapter 35. "Connor Whitby is in a very good mood today," said Samantha Green. "I wonder if that means he's finally got himself a woman."
Samantha Green, whose eldest child was in year six, did part-time bookkeeping work at the school. She charged by the hour, and Rachel suspected that St. Angela's would still pay for the time Samantha was spending outside the office next to Rachel, watching the Easter hat parade. That was the problem with having one of the mums work for the school. Rachel couldn't very well say, "Will you be billing us for this, Samantha?" When she was only there for 3 hours, it really didn't seem necessary for her to stop work to watch the parade. It wasn't like her daughter was taking part. Of course, Rachel didn't have a child taking part either, and she'd stopped work to watch. Rachel sighed. She was feeling itchy and bitchy. Rachel looked at Connor, sitting at the judge's table, wearing his pink baby's bonnet. There was something perverted about a grown man dressed up as a baby. He was making some of the older boys laugh. She thought of his malevolent face on that video, the murderous way he'd looked at Janie. Yes, it had been murderous. The police should arrange for a psychologist to look at the tape, or some expert in face reading. There were experts in everything these days. "I know the kids love him," said Samantha, who liked to wring a topic dry before she moved on to the next one. "And he's always perfectly nice to us parents, but I always sensed something not quite right about that Connor Whitby. You know what I mean?" "Oh, look at Cecilia Fitzpatrick's little girl. She's just beautiful, isn't she? I wonder where she gets it from. Anyway, my friend Janet Tyler went out with Connor a few times after her divorce, and she said Connor was like a depressed person, pretending not to be depressed. He dumped Janet in the end." "Hmm," said Rachel. "My mother remembers his mother," said Samantha. "She was an alcoholic, neglected the kids. Father ran off when Connor was a baby. Gosh, who's that with the birdcage on his head? The poor kid's going to lose it in a moment." Rachel could vaguely remember Trish Whitby turning up at church sometimes. The children were grubby. Trish scolded them too loudly during the service, and people turned to stare. "I mean, a childhood like that has to have an impact on your personality, doesn't it? Connors, I mean." "Yes," said Rachel so adamantly that Samantha looked a bit taken aback. "But he's in a good mood today," said Samantha, getting herself back on track. "I saw him in the car park earlier, and I asked him how he was, and he said, 'Top of the world.' Now that sounds to me like a man in love. Or at least a man who got lucky last night. I must tell Janet." Well, I probably shouldn't tell poor Janet. I think she quite liked him, even if he was strange. Oops, there goes the birdcage. Saw that coming." Top of the world. Tomorrow was the anniversary of Janie's death, and Connor Whitby was feeling on top of the world. Chapter 36. Cecilia decided to leave the parade early. She needed to be moving. When she sat still, she thought, and thinking was dangerous. Polly and Esther had both seen that she was there, and there was only the judging to follow, and Cecilia's daughters weren't going to win because she'd told the judges last week, 1,000 years ago, to make sure they didn't. People got resentful if the Fitzpatrick girls won too many accolades. They suspected favoritism, making them even less likely to volunteer their time to the school. She wouldn't run again for PNC president after this year. The thought struck her with absolute certainty as she bent down to pick up her bag from next to her chair. It was a relief to know one thing for sure about her future. No matter what happened next, even if nothing happened, she would not run again. It simply wasn't possible.
She was no longer Cecilia Fitzpatrick. She'd ceased to exist the moment she'd read that letter.
"I'm going," she said to Mahalia.
"Yes, go home and rest," said Mahalia. "I thought you were about to faint away for a moment there. Keep the scarf. It looks lovely on you."
As she walked through the quadrangle, Cecilia saw Rachel Crowley watching the parade with Samantha Green on the balcony outside the school office. They were looking the other way. If she was quick about it, she'd get by without them seeing her.
"Cecilia!" cried Samantha.
"Hi!" cried Cecilia, and let loose a string of violent profanities in her head. She walked towards them with her keys held prominently in her hand, so that they'd know she was in a rush, and stood as far away from them as could be considered polite.
"Just the person I wanted to see," called Samantha, leaning over the balcony. "I thought you said I'd get that Tupperware order before Easter. It's just that we're having a picnic on Sunday, assuming this lovely weather holds, and so I thought..."
"Of course," interrupted Cecilia. She stepped closer to them. Was this where she would normally stand? She'd completely forgotten about the deliveries she'd intended to do yesterday.
"I'm so sorry. This week has been... tricky. I'll come by this afternoon after I pick up the girls."
"Wonderful," said Samantha. "I mean, you just got me so excited about that picnic set. I can't wait to get my hands on it. Have you ever been to one of Cecilia's Tupperware parties, Rachel? The woman could sell ice to Eskimos."
"I actually went to one of Cecilia's parties the night before last," said Rachel. She smiled at Cecilia. "I had no idea how much Tupperware was missing from my life."
"Actually, Rachel, I can drop off your order at the same time if you like," said Cecilia.
"Really?" said Rachel. "I wasn't expecting it so soon. Don't you have to order it in?"
"I keep extra stock of everything," said Cecilia, "just in case."
Why was she doing this?
"Special overnight service for VIPs, eh?" said Samantha, who would no doubt be storing this information away for future reference.
"It's no trouble," said Cecilia. She went to meet Rachel's eyes and found it was impossible, even from a safe distance like this. She was such a nice woman. Would it be easier to justify if she wasn't nice? She pretended to be distracted by Mahalia's scarf slipping from her shoulders.
"If it suits, that would be lovely," said Rachel. "I'm taking a pavlova to my daughter-in-law's place for lunch on Easter Sunday, so one of those storage thingies would come in handy." Cecilia was pretty sure that Rachel hadn't ordered anything that would be suitable for transporting a pavlova. She'd find something and give it to her for free. "It's okay, John Paul. I gave your murder victim's mother some free Tupperware, so everything is all squared up."
"I'll see you both this afternoon," she cried, waving her keys so energetically that they flew from her hand.
"Oops-a-daisy," called Samantha.
Chapter 37. Liam won second prize in the Easter Hat Parade.